This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. This is episode 235. Hello, I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we're going to be hearing from the U.S. Equestrian Federation's Eventing Performance Director, Eric Duvander, and the Sports Director, Will Connell, about the preparations for the U.S. eventing team for the Pan Am Games, which take place this summer. And then later on in the program, we'll be continuing our series of past presidents, looking back on their term of office here at the USEA as we celebrate 60 years. And our guest this week is Kinmon Penniman, who was the president from 1996 to 1998. The Pan American Games run from August the 1st through the 4th. And just last week, the U.S. team was announced of Boyd Martin with Settleg, Doug Payne with Star Witness, Tammy Smith and Fleetworks Royal, and Lynn Szymanski with RF Callplay. I caught up with Eric Duvander to hear about the final preparations for the squad, and I began by asking him about the process of selection.
Mainly, the first big step is to have a team of excellent selectors, and I think we're really fortunate with the U.S. team that we have a very good team of selectors, and they have been working, been out there watching and giving up their free time to try to do the best decision. I mean, the American system is that people or our riders apply for to be participating in the Pan Am. So we had a big list of riders or combinations that the selects have been following and looking. So the process has been going for quite a while now. And I think it's everyone's a little pleased that we've had a wrap up and managed to pick a team now, because it's been a long, long journey to get here. I think sort of like in the lead up to now, although I've been sort of talent spotting as well and looking at how the riders have been progressing, not just our squad riders, but the riders outside of squad as well, and try to find as much time as possible to work with riders outside of our training list. So, and just be up to speed if any of those riders end up coming on board onto our teams for the Pan Am. And I think the other thing we've done this year, which has been a really exciting project, is the Futures, America's Futures Team Challenge. And that's given me an opportunity to work with some of the riders as well who were potential Pan Am riders. And so having worked with them in a team scenario has been hugely benefit, and it's been massive amounts of learning. So I think we put all the steps into place as much as we could. And the other big part is obviously what Johnny Morris works with is setting up all the logistics, and because we all have horses from the West Coast, the East Coast, and in the UK, and to get everyone to get the best preparation and then get everyone together and then travel out to Lima as a team, it's taking a bit of work. But now when we had the selection, we've had the different versions of what it could look like, but now we know that we have to travel a horse from England, and we have to travel a horse from the West Coast, and then we'll join up on the East here, East, and do some more preparations there. So it's been a lot of work, and now it's time to do the finishing touches.
Yeah, the finishing touches, of course, will lead up to the final run there at the Maryland International CCI three-star short competition. Talk a little bit about that selection, where you like them to do the final run, what you're looking for. Talk us through that process, Eric.
So, I mean, there'll be some horses that might have a run before that as well. And then, but then we have all the horses that are based in the U.S. are going to Maryland. And they've done a super job. They've offered to put on the best show they possibly can do. And Ian Stark is the course designer, and he's obviously part of my advisory group, and he works closely with me, and he's helping us to set up a sort of a course that's going to be similar to what we can expect in Lima, slightly twisty course, and not a course that should obviously also help the horses, encourage them to be brave and keep them on it. So it's not going to be a test. And how that is used, it's a little bit individual. Some horses need it to have a good run to set themselves up for later performances. Others need to run a little bit quicker to get their speed and a little bit of endurance and fitness into the horses. So it's not a competition. It is a competition that we're running our horses through, and it's not who wins gets to do anything better. The team is selected, so it's a preparation. And same thing with having Maryland with the organization, and they promise they're going to give us good ground. So if it gets a little bit firm or whatever happens, they're going to do their utmost to make sure that our horses have good footing. So we're looking forward to working with them on that final competition.
And at the same weekend, of course, for the European-based horses, they're going to go to Barbary. That's the fourth of the seventh, the same weekend in July.
I've just been over and worked with Liz, and I will hook up with her and spend time with her after Maryland and before we go to Aachen. We've also got the team competition at Aachen as well that we're working towards. So there will be opportunity for me to work with her. So we'll have someone who's keeping an eye on her out there, but I'm going to be in Maryland, and Liz is going to be working on her own out there. But she's good for it, and the course is excellent at Barbary as well. It's a perfect preparation for her.
You want them to all to have a good, comfortable run, as you say, come away with the confidence. And also, you'll be looking at the level of fitness there, what needs to be done with each of these horses in the final lead-up then, the tapering to the games and before they leave, of course. So how much influence will you have at that point, Eric, as to what the horses should do? You're working with the riders, obviously, the owners, but and their individual coaches, presumably, at that point. Just talk us through that, how you decide what the horses need to do between the final run and the games.
Well, it's basically, I mean, we're working with a team of professional riders, and it's not the first time they're getting horses ready for this level. So they know the horses and have experience of it, and it's all been done before. So there will be possibly some tweaking with some, but all the horses are in preparation now, and they've just gone through the vetting, and the riders on our list now have all got the tick of soundness and health. So they're looking in good nick as it is. And after Maryland, it's a 2 week plus 3 weeks that we can do a little bit more work, but you really don't be stretching horses in the last 3 weeks to get a lot more fitness in them. It could be the final touches of it. So the horses should be in the program right now, or are in a program right now, and in preparation, getting ready for that. So that is the fitness side. But then obviously with just getting the riders and horses tuned a couple of days before Maryland, we're going to have a 2 day training days where we're going to set up a dressage ring and go through the dressage test and have it judged. Then we're going to set up a short jump track of the same level and jump through the track, practice the warm-up routines and jump through the track, and then a bit of cross-country for those horses who need it at that stage. Then we go to Maryland and ride there, and then I'll be spending time with the riders as much as I possibly can, traveling around with them and seeing how they're operating with their personal coaches. And then and then towards the end of the month, we travel down to Stableview, which is another great venue that the owners of that have allowed us to use. And so we're very fortunate, and they're going to support us 100% with letting us use all their big arenas and the cross country and show jumps and so on. So we got 3 days of camp before we then move on down to Miami before we fly out to Lima. That's what we're doing.
That's the plan. And of course, it's down to the last minor detail here, of course, when you're planning for a major championship. But just to look at the horse and rider combinations that you've chosen as their first choice of what I know that obviously goes through the selectors, but you're then given the team that you've got. What would your individual expectations be of those combinations, knowing them as you do, Eric?
Well, I think I'm really pleased with the selection. I think it's we got some really strong experience names here. And also what I'm really pleased about, we got some new first-time team riders. I don't think Tammy Smith has been riding in a team. Doug Payne, I don't think, has ridden a team. And then traveling reserve with Liz Halliday hasn't. So it's nice to have that mixture. But they're all riding extremely well at the moment. So I think, especially with the level of competition at the three-star competition, I think I'm really comfortable with all of them. Our main goal is obviously to have a good team performance. So I can see all of them have three good phases, and that's what's key. And then honestly, any of them could actually step up and get individual medals as we go along as well, because they all have the quality to do that. So I'm not sort of pitching one person or one combination to be the one who's going to try to go for an individual goal. It's team competition. We're going to try to have the best team performance. And by doing that, if we get individual medals, I'll be thrilled.
Well, of course, the main goal is, as we know, getting that Olympic qualification. And to do that, I believe the US has to finish either on gold or silver to get to Tokyo.
Mm.
So a lot of responsibilities there, Eric, but you're used to it. Now, what are you expecting of the venue, the actual cross-country course itself? You mentioned that it would be a little bit twisty. What are your expectations of what they'll be faced with there?
Well, I personally haven't been down there, but Johnny Morris has been down there, and Will Connor has been down there, and the feedback is that the course is, weather-wise, it's going to be comfortable for the horses. I've seen the layout of the course, and it is a twisty course, so it needs to have skilled riders who can handle the turns and still be quick away from the off a turn or quick away off a fence, and having horses that are alert and read fence as well. And I think with the competitions and where I've seen our horses have been running on, they have seen similar types of track. Not exactly the same thing, but I don't think it's going to be something totally brand new. But I think with the selection done well and the experiences the horses have had, they've seen similar questions. So I'm not super concerned about that, how the track is going to roll out. It's same for every team, and I think our riders have the skills and to do it.
Super. Well, we're looking forward to it. It will be rolling around here in no time at all. August the 1st to the 4th in Lima. Eric, thank you so much for taking time to come on the programme. And we wish you the very, very best of luck and hope that you do secure that Tokyo qualification and that all the horses have a good trip.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your support. All the best.
Will Connell is the USEF's Director of Sports based in Gladstone, New Jersey, who organises the logistics for shipping a team overseas. And I spoke to Will just last week about the preparations for the squad and the personnel. And I began by asking him when the horses will ship to Lima.
Yeah, I think the first horses leave on about the 21st of July, so just over a month.
Right. Now, let's back up from that date then, Will. I mean, in terms of your preparation, how many site visits have you had, and what were you looking for then in terms of getting the horses there, you know, in that lead up to a major competition like this?
Yeah, well, I've been to Lima, I think, 4 times now, and the team leaders and Stephen Morrissey, who works with me, they've been at least a couple of times each. So we're always kind of looking at it from 3 areas, I would say. One, and obviously the most important, is the horse welfare. So that includes how we're going to fly the horses, and for Lima, we'll be working with Tim Duda. Is everything safe and reliable for their arrival into Lima and their transportation to the venue, and ensuring that their own feed and equipment can travel with them, so that the horse welfare is protected during the journey. A second area would be the venue itself, and that links into horse welfare as well, because obviously one of the key things we want to look at is the stabling and the biosecurity of the stabling and the safety. But we really want to dig into how the venue will work, where will the pinch points be, what will the storage space look like, what's the quality of the groom's accommodation, what's the people flow, the surfaces, the terrain, especially for eventing in the cross country, you know. Dressage are pretty straight. It's going to be 60 by 20 on an all-weather surface. So we want to look at the climate, obviously. And so we know everything about the venue. I mean, I would always describe it as you want to be able to go there and feel like you're at home as soon as you arrive. So that those people that haven't seen the venue, when they arrive, that first experience, we call it the golden hour, is a good experience. So the horses are straight into the stables, the grooms know exactly where they're going. If it's been a long journey, there's food and drink awaiting, and everything feels comfortable. If you get that right, then people will settle quickly, the horses will settle quickly, and there'll be a relaxed environment from the beginning. So that's the second area. And then the third area is where is everyone going to stay, transportation, etc., i.e. off venue. And in Lima, the athlete village is really the other end of town from the equestrian venue. And the traffic in Lima is probably worse than Rio in a funny sort of way. And so we've made the decision that we're going to stay near the venue in a hotel as a team, because clearly long journeys and not being able to rely on transportation times is not ideal. So we'll be staying quite near the venue. It's actually the journey time from where we're staying can be anything from about 10 or 15 minutes through to 40 minutes. So the variation is huge. So they're really the three areas. How are we going to get everyone there, especially the horses? What's the venue look like, and how can we maximize the opportunities on the venue, and then everything that happens off venue, and how are we going to make sure everyone's looked after? We got, you know, it's always difficult. You get some horses that are owned by one owner and some horses that are owned by 25 owners. So you're trying to look at what can you put in place to support owners and make sure everyone's comfortable and focused on competing and achieving the best possible result.
So how far ahead of the competition do you actually travel the horses, and what are the quarantine requirements for Lima, Will?
The horses travel, I think it's about, well, it varies really. So the show jumper's quite close to competition because they're very used to traveling. Dressage and eventing a little further out, sort of 5 days to a week out. The ideal is that they have time to settle and recover, but they're not there so long that both the horses and the athletes start to sort of get cabin fever, and you know the athletes have only got one horse to ride, they haven't got 10 horses to ride, so it's a balance between the two. In terms of quarantine, the venue is considered a quarantined venue, so the horses will arrive in Lima Airport, they'll be loaded on trucks, taken to the venue, and they won't leave the venue. Now, prior to travel, there's no specific pre-export travel quarantine required, but there are a number of procedures we have to go through in order to ensure the health certificate requirements are met, and that includes tracking where they've traveled for, I think it's 45 days before they travel, health status, etc., the normal stuff before traveling. And then when they come back into America, there is obviously the normal quarantine required, and we're working very closely through Tim Duda with USDA to make sure that quarantine coming back into America is as short as possible, and I hope that we're going to make some great progress there, but we'll know more about that in the next few days.
For those who are not familiar with that quarantine process, and I know you always try to minimize it, but what is the standard requirement? What would be the standard scenario for them coming back into the US?
Well, the standard is just under 3 days, you know, coming in from really anywhere, during which time certain blood tests have to be done. Coming back from certain countries in South America, it can be as long as 7 days. And that's what we're trying to work very hard to reduce, but obviously that's USDA's call, and I think it's really an area that we are focused on, the FEI are focused on, the movement of horses is very important. We need to make sure that obviously that health status is maintained, but that there's the simpler it is to move horses internationally, especially in South America and Americas, the easier it will be for the sport to grow and for more people to be able to compete internationally.
Where do they fly out of, Will, in this country?
Miami. All our horses will fly from Miami. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where all the other American, South American horses will fly from. There will be a number with us, but, you know, there'll be horses coming from Chile, Venezuela, Argentina, Mexico, etc., etc. But for the Pan American Games, the actual getting the horses to Lima is the responsibility of each country. For the Olympic Games, there is a central shipper appointed who organizes all the flights, and for Tokyo, that would be Pedens. So we're on the phone daily with Tim Duda, and he's outstanding at meeting all our requests and needs. So we've been working with the organizing committee to make sure we can get all our feed and medications into Peru. Our container left about a week ago, I think now, last week. So we have a container full of equipment that's already en route to Peru, and hopefully that will be there when we get there.
And how many horses in total will be traveling?
We will be taking 14 horses, which includes two travelling reserves, travelling reserve for eventing and a travelling reserve for jumping.
And personnel?
I think I did the math the other day. We're somewhere around 78 accredited personnel across the three disciplines. That's including owners, grooms, the support staff, and the athletes. So 78 accredited personnel across the three disciplines. And then there's always a gang of non-accredited supporters, friends and family, additional owners, because the accreditation for Pan Ams is similar to the Olympics in that all the accreditation comes through the National Olympic Committee. So in our case, the US Olympic Committee. The accreditation is set against number of athletes for the whole delegation. And then for equestrian, we obviously get a groom accreditation and two horse owner accreditations. But we're a very accreditation-hungry sport because everyone that actually needs to get to the horses has to be accredited. So in non-equestrian disciplines, an athlete can leave the venue to meet with a physical therapist or a sports psychologist or somebody like that. They don't necessarily have to be accredited. Clearly, the horse can't walk out and meet a physio in Starbucks. So we are a very accreditation-hungry sport. But we're the only sport that gets accreditations for owners or for anyone similar. So if you went and purchased a boat for a sailor, you wouldn't get accreditation. We're the only sport that gets accreditation in that area. So, which is great because obviously the horse owners are essential to our sport. But sometimes people say, well, why can't there be more horse owner accreditations? Well, actually, it's good that we have two.
And for anyone who's listening, Will, who's probably thinking of going down to spectate to enjoy the competition, is there anything that you would recommend in terms of the logistics and the climate, what the what temperatures are going to be like, what they can expect?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that Lima is one of the greatest cities for restaurants that I've visited. So if you enjoy good food, you're going to enjoy Lima. There's two main things. Firstly, you need to get a hotel, and obviously I would recommend going for a 4-star hotel at least, and choose the area carefully. So Miraflores is the kind of more touristy area, or if you're going to be up near the venue in La Molina, then make sure the hotel has the level of service that you're expecting. The second big challenge is transportation, and I would strongly recommend people do not rent cars because there is no parking at the venue, and driving in Lima is enjoyable if you like having a high heart rate and a high adrenaline rate. But I would recommend working with a car service, which you can usually access through the hotel, or there are plenty if you search the web. In terms of the climate, it's a really difficult climate to explain, really, because it's winter winter in Lima, and there really isn't a lot of sun, and there's a lot of cloud cover. It's not necessarily cold. It's probably be between 50 and 70, but there will be a high moisture percentage in the air, which makes it feel colder. And so layers, light layers of clothing is what's needed. The other thing I would say if someone is going, the city isn't polluted, but because of the cloud cover and where it sits between the sea and the mountains, it's pretty common for people that are asthma sufferers to feel the symptoms increase. So if someone's going who's an asthma sufferer, take plenty of medication. Now, obviously, if that's an athlete, they have to stick within the clean sport regulations, but that would be a recommendation I'd give people.
And were there any surprises for you then, Will, when I know you've been a few times, but when you first went there, were there any moments you thought, well, I didn't expect this in Lima?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, when you're part of a multi-sport games. There's always going to be some sort of compromise in terms of some of the venues. I mean, if you're a track and field athlete, then an athletic stadium is an athletic stadium pretty much in terms of the field of play. I think where we've ended up, it's a complete rebuild. It's a military venue. The stables are very good. The venue is small, and I think the cross country is going to be, well, I know the cross country is going to be very, very twisty. I think that in a way, we would have probably liked a more flowing cross-country course, but that's the compromise, that this was the venue that was chosen. So I think the traffic probably surprised us a little when we've been there, and that has kind of played on how we've put together the plan. But yeah, the venue's small, tight, and certainly when there's a lot of horses on venue, the training areas will need a lot of management. And I think when the riders have finished the cross country, they might be a little cross-eyed. Otherwise, it's a multi-sport games. We work very close with the USOC. Every time we've been to Lima, everyone's very welcoming, it's a great city to visit. As I say, the restaurants are amazing. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting place.
Well, we look forward to it. Well, I want to thank you for taking time to come on the program. I'm going to wish you the very best of luck with the rest of the logistics, the travel to Lima, and, of course, the unfolding of what we hope will be a great games for us.
Yeah, well, the aim for eventing is Olympic qualification. That's the first and foremost.
It is the priority. All right. Well, I know you'll do your best. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Will.
Thank you, Chris.
And we continue now with our series of past presidents as we celebrate 60 years here at the USEA. And joining me now is Kingman Pennyman, who was president from 1996 to 1998, and then again returned as interim president for 2004. Welcome to the program, Kim. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, we're going to look back at your term of office there, or two terms, actually, 1996 to 1998 and then 2004. But when you look back to the those days just before being President King, do you remember what was on your mind then and what you were thinking? Well, these are the kinds of changes I would like to see. This is what I would like to be as my legacy as a president. What thoughts did you have going into the presidency?
Well, I joined the board in 1992 in Pittsburgh. It was rather a tumultuous period. A lot of things were going on. The sport was pretty fragmented. As you know, that it almost took 6 years in the making, but the decision of where to move the headquarters or to move the headquarters was, you know, really split the board up. And there were a lot of things that people were concerned about. But I think that from my perspective, when I joined the board in 1992, they immediately gave me some administrative and financial oversight responsibilities. Maybe because of perhaps I was in Vermont, I was designated as the board representative to go down to the office in Massachusetts and find out how things were going, what was going on, what our recommendation would be. So I got to know the staff very well, going down there and talking to them and getting a good feeling for where they were, what their problems were. You've probably talked to Dennis, in terms of our previous president before me, or two, I should say, is Denny Emerson with the Eileen. And there are a lot of things that were happening. But I got to get a good sense from an administrative and financial perspective of what was going on with the sport. And I continued to work on that one. I think that I was sort of lucky in that there were certain people that I really didn't know. I was rather naive that when I went on the board that perhaps other people had other expectations for me. That ultimately ended up with my becoming president, as you indicated, in 1996. And I think I was very, very lucky that I had a great staff to work with. But really important, I think, from my perspective was, I call them my angels, but I had General Burton, Fritz, and Walter Strauss that really wrapped themselves around me. They spent an awful lot of time with me, whether I was at an HSA meeting, a USCTA meeting, wherever I was. Those three were always had me sitting in the middle of them. Sometimes I could remember one of them, you know, poking me and said, "King, stand up." Argue. But I think from their perspective, you know, they gave me a lot of color from the history of the sport, where we were and what trouble we were in. And I think I can remember in San Diego, as soon as it was announced that I had was president and was elected, Walter Strauss came up to me. And as you know, Walter, he said, "Young man, I want you to know your sport is financially bankrupt. What are you going to do about it?" So we knew we had a lot of stuff to do. But I think that when they really helped me in terms of, you know, from the horse perspective, the rider's perspective, putting the history of the sport in where it was so you had solid footing to go forward, I think we were very lucky because we were able to turn the sport around. It was a time where there's a lot of growth. I can remember our concerns on the board were oversubscriptions at events. We didn't have enough events. We had record levels of membership. But I think when I look back, obviously, 1996 was the opening of our headquarters in Virginia. And that took a lot of time prior to my being president, working with the financing and getting everything moved, but getting to know the staff. I look at 1997 as going, and which was a little bit, the board finally came around of putting the USCTA on a better financial footing by instituting some significant increases in membership fees that we could then turn around and put into the sport. I think in 1998, of course, was the promotion of the lower riders and novice, the beginner novice. I think it was 1998 that we finally put the beginner novice as a subdivision in the rules book. That among some people, the old sports, was not well taken care of. But at the same time, I think we spent a lot of time also making sure that I think at my first board meeting in Virginia, where we talked about the pyramid, where our Olympic riders were at the top, but without a strong base underneath of the amateur riders, we couldn't have a strong sport. They subsidized everything else we were doing. So I think from that perspective, both the beginner novice at the lower levels, and then also obviously helping push through during that period the 4-star event at Lexington.
And that was something that you were passionate about, wasn't it? The lower levels, the beginner novice, and I believe you were instrumental in also ensuring that they became a part of the AECs.
And yes, I mean, I think, you know, we created, I believe, in the area, I think it was in 1998, where we created the Novice Rider Championship at the area levels, for both the horse and the rider. And then, you know, we kept pushing that forth. And of course, you know, it was in my second term that, was the inauguration of the, AEC's national, championship there in North Carolina in 2004.
So what other key, aspects of the association did you find that were your major sort of milestones within your term of office, King? What you otherwise focused on?
Well, you know, as I said in my exiting letter, there were both some very highs and some very disabling or disability, you know, going low. Obviously, when you try and push through a lot of programs and you're an outsider, you're going to create a little bit of friction and resistance. And certainly, you know, I think we got it, but I think we had a board and a staff that stood up and said, no, this is what we need to do. Without them, I couldn't have done it. But I think was trying to figure out what the sport needed and where, if it was to survive and grow, you know, where our focus should be. And I think it was a feeling that it should be on the membership and it should be on the horse. And so I think that, you know, from having known the staff, probably the thing that I take away with the most satisfaction is convincing Joe Whitehouse to leave New England and move to Virginia. And then in 1998, at my last annual meeting, promoting Joe Whitehouse as the executive director.
And in terms of the events during that time, what were the key events that you remember and their development in terms, indeed, of their evolution?
Well, I think it was, the sport was trying to decide. You know, now that I look back and I, you know, read and see a lot of things, you know, you're seeing the sport sort of taking itself a little bit apart among the top riders and the lower riders and who gets purse money and who doesn't. And perhaps starting to act and look like some of our other affiliates, which it wasn't the case when I was there. But I think that when you look at it, is, you know, it's constantly evolving. There's always change. You know, you see the sport, you know, the national, the FEI, it was, you know, at one point saying we're going to take things away, and then they said, no, we want to grab as much as we can from you. I think the other, one of the things that I surprised people with was at the annual meeting in Minneapolis in 1998 is when I had the president from the British Horse Society come and give the major speech to explain to our members what it meant and the efforts that they had to take. I don't know if you remember that they had quite a bit of turbulence in getting and maintaining their independence.
I do.
And so I brought them over, and that obviously raised a lot of eyebrows as he explained their history and their development and what we should be looking for and what we should be watching out for. But I think the eventers are a special breed. They're independent. They're, you know, I still think it's the best, you know, sport there is. We watched what was happening at the USDF and their negotiations that didn't seem to be working well. So I think the sport is well stead by being strong, by maintaining its roots and having a solid base and trying to keep as much control of their sport as they can. And I think they've done an excellent job since I've long gone in 2004.
How do you look back at that time in office then, King? What would you say you most enjoyed about being the president?
I think I enjoyed that it was a sport that was growing. It was a sport that wanted to get together. It was a sport that recognized its potential and that we were able, with the people working with me, to put a lot of those factors into place. People were friendly. People were happy. I remember what John, the old, who retired from the Chronicle of the Horse, came up to me after Minneapolis and said, you know, King, all your event meetings, they're all big parties. And I said, exactly. We had fun. We, you know, I mean, that was the purpose of the sport. You know, we had our problems. We had a rule committee. We worked on things. But, you know, we wanted to be unified and we wanted to be cohesive in where we wanted to go, and we could do it in a manner that, you know, people could do it in a friendly way. But clearly, you know, I always laugh that my introduction through the sport was, you know, I started riding at the lower level, but my wife, Margot, was riding at the higher level, and so we traveled all over New England and everything, and I got to meet most of the top riders and everybody. But she always complained that as my influence in the sport rose, her dressage scores went down.
And she'll always hold you accountable for that.
Absolutely, to this day. Because there was an old guard. I mean, you know, and then I appreciated that. I can remember I had good relationships with David O'Connor. But, you know, he shifted over to what became the USEF. But I remember him telling somebody that, you know, King has a lot of great ideas, but the problem is at some point King will leave and the rest of us have to make our living on the sport and some of the changes he's making. And I think there's a certain amount of, you know, truth to that.
Right. And then, of course, there was Loris Henry, who followed you, and Charles Lloyd. And then you came back as interim president in 2004. Talk a little bit about that year.
Yeah, that was a, again, I think that we were having some, you know, there was friction within the USCTA and the HSA, you know, the USCTF, Charles brought me in to be as a representative. I went back on the board. I always laughed and said I was, you know, on the board of the HSA, whether it's the U.S. Equestrian Federation and then the USET. But I was on the, you know, was brought there again to try and, I guess, stem the tide a little bit. But then I think we were all surprised when Charles announced unexpectedly that he was not going to finish his term, and he left an open term. And the question was, what do we do about it? There was a vacuum that was created. A decision was made to bring me back on the board and make me president. And again, there were a lot of the old venters that said, you know, we're sort of losing it. What do we do to try and make it stronger? So I tried to bring on some members that, you know, would be there to support me. We had various different conversations with John Long, very transparent. But it was also a good time, and, you know, at the end of the time that, you know, we were able to reach some agreement that we were an independent sport. But at the same time, it also was, you know, making sure the sport continued to grow, and the area championships became the national championships. And that was a big thing, I think, in trying to bring all the sports. And I think it was a year after that that we brought big, novice and began to pack into. They weren't initially as part of it, but they were in subsequent years included.
Any final thoughts, King, when you look back at your contribution to the association and where it is now?
I think we're all parts of pieces. You know, I think that we're building blocks. You know, my feeling was at the time when I left and I, you know, was talking to Joe and others and was saying that, you know, now that the sport is on stronger financial footing, the fun is really going to start as people start fighting over who gets what. And I think that's probably continuing. I think, you know, I don't like to see the division between, you know, the top riders in our sport as to who has control. Maybe there's, you know, but that's the problem we have is how do we develop our best riders and provide them funding at the same time that the sport is. But I think from New England's perspective, every year we're losing another event to land. We're losing events because we're not seeing as much eventers in New England as we used to. It has moved south. But we got to do what we can do to remember that we're a national sport.
King, thank you very much indeed for taking time to come on the program and look back down the history of the sport and your contribution to it as president. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Chris. Enjoyed speaking to you. Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. My thanks again to our guests, Eric Duvander and Will Connell, and to Kingman Penniman. Do join us again in 2 weeks' time for another episode of the USEA's official podcast. In the meanwhile, please follow us on social media at US Eventing, where you'll be able to keep up with all the latest news, of course, on our social media channels, as well as online at useventing.com. And if you're listening on the website, you can also download this to any podcast app so you can take it with you wherever you go. Until the next time, thank you for listening and enjoy your eventing.